You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Weight loss solutions are not one size fits all. Hers makes it simpler to get started and stick with a weight loss plan backed by expert guided online care that puts your weight loss goals first. These include oral medication kits or compounded GLP-1 injections. Through Hers, pricing for oral medication kits start at just $69 a month for a 10-month plan when paid in full upfront. No hidden fees, no membership fees. You shouldn't have to go out of your way to feel like yourself. Hers brings expert care straight to you with 100% online access to personalized treatment plans that put your goals first. Reach your weight loss goals with help through Hers. Get started at forhers.com/foryou to access affordable, doctor-trusted weight loss plans. That's forhers.com/foryou, forhers.com/foryou. Paid for by Hims and Hers Health. Weight loss by Hers is not available everywhere. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Restrictions at forhers.com. Apply.
Today we welcome Sarah Mastros, author of the Orphic Hymns Grimoire. Together, Sarah and I had a really great time discussing the origins of Orphism and its role in the ancient world, touching on a wide range of concepts such as the chthonic roots of Orphic practice, the four magical bards, catabasis, Persephone and compost, becoming muse-touched, and how these powerful and fascinating hymns can be utilized by the modern sorcerer. Sarah's book, from Hadean Press, is more than a simple translation of the Orphic hymns, but a vast collection of spells and rituals ready to be explored and applied, ultimately providing a comprehensive and approachable access point to these ancient practices. I am your host, Matt Hadfield, and it is with great pleasure that I welcome Sarah Mastros to the Hadean Press podcast. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Sarah, as well as being an author, you also have a significant presence online, and you provide workshops and classes on a wide range of subjects related to magic. Could you tell us a little more about what got you started on your path?
Well, that is a hard question. I get asked this question a lot, and I feel like there's no like day I became a witch, but there's definitely a day when I found out other people were also witches. So many people have heard me tell this story before. In this story, I don't have a great memory, so I worry that people have heard this story on 6 podcasts and some of the details are different. I'm doing my best, guys. In this story, I'm 9 to 11, maybe. My mostly estranged grandfather sent me a birthday gift. Note, it was not even remotely my birthday, but that's cool, whatever. He sent me like a gift certificate to a mail order book catalog and a paper catalog. Now, for young people, I want to remind you guys that this story is set in like olden times and there's no internet. And I grew up in Amish country. So like the books that were available, I mean, I'm not Amish. I didn't grow up on a farm, but I'm saying I grew up in the country in a place where there was not a lot of like witchcraft books available, right? So pickings were slim until I got this mail order book catalog. And I was looking through and there in the nonfiction section was a subject called witchcraft. And I knew what nonfiction meant. That meant it was real. And I was excited. And I was like, Mom, 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 are witches real? And she very politically said, some people think they are witches, which, like, I've had occasion to say that in my life as well, right? I was like, can I buy a book of witchcraft? She's like, you definitely can, but you're going to be disappointed. I mean, I think my parents thought it was a phase I would grow out of, which I definitely have not. But I got two books, which she was right, were both pretty disappointing, but for different reasons. The first one was, I feel bad, I don't actually remember the name of this book. I just call it Buckland's Big Blue Book of Bibbidi Bobbidi Boo, and people know what I mean. It's like, at least in the US, right? The version we had was like an 8.5 by 11 bright blue book with a white pentagram on the front by Ray Buckland. Maybe it's called like Encyclopedia of Witchcraft, or I don't know. It has some really generic like introduction to witchcraft type title, but it was like one of the only books on the market. And that book was about what we would now call, it was about like the non-initiatory kind of British-ish Wicca. So like not Gardnerian or Alexandrian, but like the pop version of that, basically, which in the 90s or the 80s, really, when this story is set in the US, we would have just called that Wicca. And that book was like interesting, and I learned a lot of good things from it. I also maybe learned some bad things from it. I will say that the good things I learned from that book are like magic is real, and like you can learn to be a magician, but it's hard and you're going to have to actually work at it. Great lesson. And I learned that like real magic is like hidden between the lines in mythology and folklore and history. And if you look for it there, you can find it. Also, an excellent lesson I feel has served me very well. Also, I learned some other things, like you have to have one he god and one she god, which I will say I was fully prepubescent and quite sheltered when I learned that. And I like did not really understand what they were talking about. So I picked Hermes and Hecate, like the most genderqueer lord and lady I could have picked. And I got, no lie, that's been working great for me this whole time. So that was the one book, and I liked it. It had a lot of good information, and it felt like I was really learning things. But, like, aesthetically, it was, like, not, I don't know. It had no, like, fairy tale romance to it, if you know what I mean, right? I got another book called The Encyclopedia of White Witchcraft, I think, by Patty Slade, which was gorgeous. It was like a coffee table book. It had like these full page, full color nature photos of like, that is what we would, I guess, now call maybe like British traditional witchcraft, but like a little bit on the like lighter end and not the like ooky spook end, I guess. I mean, I don't, I feel like everything has a name now. Between you and me, I feel like British traditional witchcraft is definitely not traditional. And like, honestly, I'm a little sus that it's British, but you know what I mean? Like, I don't know. It had that vibe to it. And that book was gorgeous and like aesthetically great. And it definitely had like a sort of like, I don't know, like a witchy vibe to it that I was there for. But like objectively, I could not tell you anything I learned from that book, which was basically just like, here's the wheel of the year. Like, well, like aesthetically, I liked all the things she was saying. And I was like 9 to 11, so I will say if I went back and reread that book, I imagine her, like, you know, fact-checking could use some help. But she definitely presented this idea of witchcraft as like a, you know, like in the like Margaret Murray way, which I was there for. The historical accuracy of that, I don't know. But as a like romantic mythology, the idea of like a prehistoric feminist witchy goddess cult, like I'm there for that idea. Like it is inspirational. As a matter of fact, I prefer my feminist utopias in the future rather than the past.
Yeah, we might touch on that later on with Ursula Le Guin a bit, but
oh please. So that's how I got started, and then from there it was, I will really say, Ray Buckland's teaching that like it is there written between the lines, and you just have to like nerd for it, like that really made a big impression on me. And I feel like that's what I do for a living, is I read carefully between the lines of things and like tease the magic out.
That's a really excellent point. So in our interview today, we're going to focus on your most recent text from Haydean Press, the Orphic Hymns Grimoire. Could you tell us a little about what the Orphic Hymns actually are?
The Orphic Hymns are a collection of sacred poetry from ancient Greece in the form that I would say, I personally would say there are like, there are two most important like collections of sacred invocational poetry, what we would call hymns in ancient Greece, the Homeric hymns and the Orphic hymns. The Orphic hymns in the form we know them were probably written on like, I would say like the western coast of Turkey, somewhere between probably like 300 BCE and 300 CE, but almost undoubtedly like reflect an older oral tradition. Relative to the Homeric hymns, and also relative to like what I think, at least in America, we think of as like sort of mainstream Greek mythology, Orphism is its own thing, which is like more maybe mystic and ecstatic, and is not fully approved of by like the upper class Athenian elites, who feel like Orphism is for women, slaves, foreigners, and other undesirables. And when I heard that, I was like, oh, they mean me. I'm the undesirable. Got it. Right. And so that was like what attracted me to Orphism. There are 88 of these hymns. We don't know for sure who wrote them. One legend says they were written by Pythagoras, which is my personal favorite legend, although I do not believe that to be true. So Orphic Hymns Grimoire has my translation from the Greek into modern English. Like modern vernacular English. For each hymn, it also has an icon, like a coloring book style image of the god in question for each one. And then there's like additional stuff, which started off as just like footnotes to my translations, but rapidly turned into half the book. So there's a lot of like historical and cultural context. Some of them have spells that go with them. Some of them have like sort of some additional like stories, some original mythology, but most of them have some combination of like historical context, some like linguistic context about the hymn, and usually a spell or a ritual to go with them. And I tried to, the ones that have more comments are sometimes the ones that like I have a lot to say about, but also I tried to say more about like the things that I thought were harder to learn about, right? So like Athena, for example, had, there's very little extra material about Athena, which is partly like, that's not, I mean, not that I have any issue with Athena much, but like, I don't, I'm not an Athena devotee. And I think a close reading of this text, I think you can really tell which ones are my favorites and which aren't. And similarly for the illustrator, and those are not the same like mix. Like he, his Hercules icon is amazing. In my opinion, maybe the best one in the book. And that's because like he, like that is a spirit he works with a lot, but also it's because his background is in comic book art, which is like really well suited to Hercules, the superhero.
Right. So what is it specifically about Greek mythology that captured your attention in the first place?
Well, my I'm Greek on my father's side, so I sort of grew up with a lot of Greek mythology. And I definitely, so I'm Greek on my father's side and Jewish on my mother's side, Ashkenaz on my mother's side. And I definitely grew up with the understanding that like the gods of ancient Greek were the gods of my father's people in exactly the same way that I understood like the God of Israel to be the God of my mother and my mother's people. Like to me, that was just the exact same relationship. Though I grew, what I usually say is that like I grew up atheist, but I don't practice anymore. Like I'm a recovering atheist. The other thing is, at least in the States, like we get Greek mythology as just like part of our cultural inheritance. Like we learn some, I mean not much, but like we learn about the Greek slash Roman myths in school. And so I guess for me, like those were just the, that was the first kind of paganism I encountered. And, you know, when I was coming up in Wicca, I was told that like, you should focus on like the pagan ways of your ancestors. Advice I do not entirely agree with, But for me, that meant like Judaism and Greek mythology. And that is such a like rich, I never ran out of that. You know what I mean? Like, that's like a lot of magic in between those two. And I'm particularly interested in where they overlap. So I'm particularly interested in like Hellenic Judaism and in things like Orphism that are, you know, we don't always contextualize it this way, but like a lot of Orphism is about the influence of Judaism and other like Semitic and Levantine faiths into Greek mythology. Like Orphism has this like Eastern inheritance more than what we think of as like mainland mainstream Greek mythology, which is what people think of when they think of Greek mythology is Homeric mythology filtered through British Victorian neoclassicism. Like that's actually what people are thinking about when they think about Greek mythology generally. And compared to like that, Orphism is definitely like has a more like Anatolian and Middle Eastern influence and is a little more, I'm about to say something that, sorry, I know I paused for a long time. I'm trying to think about how to say this. To grossly oversimplify, Orphism is more of a like people's religion and Homeric religion is maybe for like rich men.
The polis.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's complicated. Like, look, ancient, what we call ancient Greece, I'm making air quotes that no one can see because this is radio. Like, what we call ancient Greece is actually like thousands of years and like...
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
And ranges from northern India to like southern France. Like that's what we mean when we say ancient Greek. So there's a lot of different things going on. But broadly, Orphism is maybe... Homeric mythology is really filtered through some upper... There's a lot of what it turns out is like Athenian political propaganda woven into it.
So like more state religion as opposed to folk religion?
Yeah, yes, that's what I'm getting at. But of course, it's more complicated because there's not one state. There's a whole bunch of different states who are at war with each other a lot.
And thousands of years of history.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Exactly. And Orphism, yeah. In which the Orphic hymns are quite late. Like the Orphic hymns, to contextualize for people, are basically the same age as the newest parts of the Jewish Bible and the oldest parts of the Christian Bible. Another way to say that would be like they are roughly coextant with like the PGM, the Greek Magical Fire. Like that's broadly the same time period. That is to say, much later than like Plato or Homer. Though again, the Orphic, like Orphism is old. It's just this particular version that we have.
That survived.
Of it, that survived, which only barely survived and only survived in Arabic libraries. I'm not a textual historian, so it's possible that what I'm about to say is wrong, but I'm pretty sure that what I'm about to say is true. And that is all European copies of the Orphic hymns come from a single manuscript that was imported from Constantinople into Italy. I'm going to say that that happens maybe around 1500, but I didn't prepare for this okay. interview, so I'm not 100% sure on that like exact date.
So who exactly was this figure, Orpheus?
Okay, so there are four like legendary magician bards in Greek culture that we talk about, right? I'm going to go backwards in time. So the newest one, like, is Hesiod, right? Who was definitely, almost certainly a specific historical person who, like, wrote things down, right? Not an oral tradition, but he's writing. We know that because in some of his books in the introduction, he, like, tells personal stories about how, like, his father moved him to this shithole in the middle of nowhere, and now he's involved in, like, an inheritance dispute with his brother. And those are, like, not the kind of details you would expect to be transmitted in an oral tradition, right? So he's probably a specific person, specific time. The next one is Homer, who probably isn't a specific person. It's probably a relatively small group of people developing an oral tradition over time. As we go back, The next two are Orpheus and Musaios, right? So Orpheus is sort of the oldest figure. I don't think anyone thinks Orpheus is, like, a specific historical figure in any way. Like, that is the same way, like, Hercules. Like, this is a myth, or Jason from, like, Jason the Argonauts. Like, this is a fully mythological person that, like, probably is based on some kind of conglomeration of people from some time, right? So he is he is the son of Calliope, the leader of the Muses. He is, like, a magical bard, basically, right? There's a lot of stories. You know, can I read a poem?
Of course.
So I have a poem about Orpheus in this book. Okay, so this is not a translation. This is just a poem I wrote called A New Hymn for Orpheus. Listen to this tale of the poet most renowned, hero and mystic, weaving magic made from sound. Orpheus, an orphan slave from ever-blessed Thrace, whose ecstatic charismatic rites crack open heaven's face, and under peal of thunder drums trace a path from trance to grace, redeeming what merely seems and revealing what's been debased. The son of songstress muse, high priest of all harmonics, archaic storytelling bard hooked on heaven's phonics, great cosmic voice that opens up the heavenly abode, goetic oracle and orator, our hero and rhapsode rose swift to fame and fortune for the stories that he told. He spoke the language of the birds and sang them from the trees. He sailed the seas out to the east to seize the golden fleece. He raised the sailors' spirits and sang the fish up from the seas. He outsang Siren's serenade, thus besting bitter banshees. Some say it was at a wedding that he met his soul's true love, the princess Eurydice called Justice wide above. But she was bitten by a viper, and he held her wailing woe as her soul flickered and fled and made its descent into the depths below. Others say she was immortal, and her descent not deathly loss, that she is great Hecate, hidden in patriarchal gloss. In any case, brave Orpheus sought his love below the dark. He crossed the river of life and death, the true magician's mark. With seven songs for seven steps, he charmed his way below, through dark and cold and death and lethe into the earth's hollow. The queen of hell fell under his spell, enchanted by the sound, and found his love where she lay bound beneath the ancient mound. With further songs and spells, he charmed the guardian of the dead, cracking locks and rolling rocks that blocked where justice laid her head. The queen gave leave to lead his love back up above the ground, but Orpheus, hell said to him, you mustn't turn around. Orpheus, still young and brash, failed the dark queen's test, so Hecate Eurydice sleeps on Persephone's blessed breast. In impotent goetic woe, Orpheus returned to wild Thrace and once again gained widespread fame for his voice and pretty face. But he wallowed in bitter fury, forswearing she who was his love. He blasphemed the queen below and worshipped only him above. He taught his men to oppress women and engage in child rape. So Maenads ripped him limb from limb and took that pretty face. With such death, his soul was cleansed, his rage finally abated, and he came at last to his true love's arms in the dark where she had waited. Orpheus died while he yet lived. That's what makes a mage. He went below and rose again. He paid hell's steep tithe wage. If you would follow in his steps, if you would open up the ways, dare to raise Keyholder's torch and seek wide justice always. This secret rite will teach to you if you read his hymns with care and allow illuminating dark to lay the long way bare. Mystery cannot be penetrated. She must penetrate you. Climb your way up out of hell, but keep faith with what's beneath you.
What a wonderful historiola, his life. My first question immediately from listening to that wonderful poem is exactly how much of a chthonic tradition does Orpheism represent?
Look, as I said, you know, we all have our biases. I definitely, Orphic Hymns Grimoire has a clear chthonic slant. Orphism certainly has a chthonic slant relative to mainstream Greek mythology, right? So, okay, Orphism can mean a lot of different things. I'm not going to have this quote exactly right because I didn't look it up, but there's a famous classicist named Martin West, and he says that something very like that Orphism is the tradition for naming things after Orpheus. I'm like, that's true. It's kind of hard to say exactly what Orphism means, but broadly, there are sort of two things we mean. One thing that we mean is like a style of practice, right? It is what we would today, at least in the States, call a charismatic or ecstatic practice. So like snake handling and like flopping around on the floor, speaking in tongues and all that business, that like in ancient Greece, they would call that kind of practice Orphic, and they would mean it in the exact kind of like disapproval way that I just said, like snake handlers, you know, right? Like it wasn't a full, it was a pretty pejorative term when applied by certain people like say Plato, right? But Orphism is also, it has its own like sort of cosmology and theology that is like similar to what we think of as mainstream Greek mythology, but focuses more on sort of chthonic aspects and particularly on like Demeter, Persephone, and especially Dionysus. And has to grossly oversimplify, they have like an elder Dionysus called Zagreus, who is generally understood to be the son, maybe by adoption, of Persephone. And there's like a whole Zagreus mythology, but Zagreus is like in Orphism, presented as sort of like the first coming of Dionysus, and what we think of as Dionysus is like the second coming of Dionysus. And that thing that I just said about like Zagreus dies and is born again as Dionysus, that dying and rising thing is quite central to Orphism, which is in essence a reincarnation cult, I would say. Like, I'm gonna get some pushback. To grossly oversimplify, I would say the essential mystery of Orphism is reincarnation.
Okay, all right. And of course, you just mentioned previously as well, this is a grimoire. So why is it that you refer to this text as a grimoire?
Well, I understand the word grimoire to mean a lot of different things, but first and foremost, I understand it to mean like a textbook in this tradition, which now I think we might call Goetia, right? Though that word can mean a whole lot of different things. But like there is a tradition that like I'm going to start talking about in like the PGM, which obviously also has like a whole long complex history, but starting with like that sort of magic and working its way through like the Hygromantia and then through like the Solomonic magical tradition. We have these textbooks of that tradition, which are called grimoires. The word grimoire means textbook. It is closely related to the word grammar, right? But grimoire can mean a lot of other things too, right? Normally when we talk about a grimoire, we're talking about like a spirit catalog, right? Which Orphic Hymns definitely is. And we are talking about a spirit catalog with like some invocation instructions, but the Orphic Hymns are invocations. That is their essential nature. And also there's a bunch of like spells in it. So that's why I chose the word grimoire for it, is to like situate it clearly in that tradition. Though I definitely understand that, like, I am not saying that the Orphic Hymns themselves should be understood as a grimoire, which I don't think. I think they are best understood as the, like, liturgy of an Orphic rite. And something that I think not everybody understands, but I promise you, if you just read all of them in order, will become clear to you. It is one continuous liturgy for one ritual. Like they're not, they're in order as a full ritual. And I don't know how to explain that except to say, like, as a magician, if you read them, you can tell. Like they're, you know, it starts off by opening the gates with Persephone, and then you slowly move into like night. So this is a ritual that happens at night. Dawn is at quite near the end, right? And there's like this building of power. And then in the middle, it sort of peaks with Aphrodite, and then this sort of like eye of the storm, like series of Dionysus hymns. That's where like maybe the real mystic oomph is. And then it's a catabasis rite. You work your way down into the underworld from there, and then like death is near the end, and then you come back up at the end.
Very similar to the Historioli you just read of Orpheus.
Yeah, I mean, there's like in Greek magic in particular, but also like what we think of as Anglophone magic is deeply built on that same tradition, right? Like
the fundamentals of ritual.
Yeah, there's like a structure to a ritual that is also like the structure of like a Catholic mass. Like there's just a way to structure a ritual in that tradition. Whereas I will say like Jewish ritual, there's like a different structure to it. So you could also write like things on that, on other ritual frameworks. But what we think of as like a normal ritual framework in our Anglophone culture is built out of partly this ancient Greek format. And so like, and that's what I mean. So as English speaking magicians, like it's a familiar narrative structure to the ritual.
So the first part of your book begins with a warning and a quote from one of my favorite science fiction authors, Ursula Le Guin, who said—
My favorite as well.
She said, "I love translation because I translate for love. I'm an amateur. I translate a text because I love it, or I think I do. And love craves close understanding. Translation for me is discovery." I would really love to hear more about why you chose this quote and why you wrote, "This book is a game of scholarship, one I hope you will enjoy playing with me."
Ah, well, let me start by saying the sentence immediately before what you wrote, which is that this work is not a work of scholarship, right? I guess technically I am a scholar, but my field of scholarship is theoretical mathematics and not this. But like, I am not a scholar and I am not attempting to engage. Like,
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Nerd, and I try and be right about stuff. Like I have a deep commitment to like speaking true things in books, right? But I'm not a scholar and I am uninterested in producing academic work. I know because I quit academia, to which like I did that for a while in math of all things, and I don't want to do that anymore, right? So for me, right, like the Orphic hymns are the first thing I ever like sort of translated in a magical way, right? Like I mentioned I was a mathematician for a while. My specialty was cryptography, and I'm like, I don't know, devil tongued. Like I'm pretty good at languages. Like, I my brain does that pretty okay. But like, so I would sometimes read magical texts in not my native language, and not languages I'm fluent in. Like, I want to be clear. I am not fluent in Greek. Like I can, also I will say I'm like skeptical about what it even means to be fluent in an ancient language, but like I am, and I'm not a linguist, right? Like I can read ancient Greek enough, I guess, right? And I'm a language nerd, so I can like really deep dive into it when I want to. But Orphicans are the first thing I ever sort of translated for other people. And it went like this. I was working with Thomas Taylor's hymns. And the more I learned about like Greek history and mythology, sometimes I'd be reading them and I'm like, that doesn't sound like something somebody in ancient Greece would say. That sounds like something a British Victorian neoclassicist would say, right? And so I started looking to the Greek because there were certain places where like, I was like, is it? And I would go back and look at the Greek and dig in and be like, oh, that's not how I would translate that. Like, it's not that I would say it was wrong, but we all bring our bias, right? And Thomas Taylor's bias and my bias are actually pretty close. Like, Thomas Taylor was routinely referred to as Thomas the Pagan Taylor by his contemporaries. And rumor has it he sacrificed a goat in his backyard every time he started translating a new text. Like,
that's
he's a lot cooler. He's like so much cooler than people know about. Please, somebody listening, please like write a biography of that guy because he's awesome, or make a mini series of his life. Like, he's a cool guy. But yeah, so that's how it started. And then I started putting some on Facebook. And, you know, I don't know, I enjoy writing poetry. So I made them a lot. Okay, there are only four. Well, actually, now there's a new one that just came out that I haven't even read yet. When I wrote this book, there were basically two English translations available. Thomas Taylor's, which I should have really looked up these dates before this interview. Maybe let's say 1790s.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think it's around the 1800s.
Yeah, it's right around 1800. Like, I'm confident that it comes out sometime between like 1790 and 1815, in that range, right? And it's poetic, right? Like, it's got a strong meter, it rhymes.
Yeah, it's what I've used for years now.
Yeah, it's what I used for many years. Like, I am in no way throwing shade on that translation. Also, it's available free on the internet, right? Like, I'm into that. But like I said, you know, it is a product of its times, and that is woven through it, right? The other comment translation is by Apostolos Athanasakis, which is a very like academic. I'm skeptical about ever using the word literal to describe a translation of poetry, especially magic poetry, because like, do you even poetry? Like, you know what I mean? Like, a word for word literal translation to me seems like it misses the point of poetry entirely, but it's super useful as a like historical tool. And that book, I will say, has tons of like amazing footnotes. It's a good book. I strongly recommend it. Those were the only two on the market when I wrote mine. Patrick Dunn wrote another translation that came out basically the same time as mine, which is also fabulous. And in truth, if his had already been out, I probably wouldn't have bothered to write one. I don't know if he would say the same. Probably. And then there's a new one, actually, that just came out a little bit ago that I have not read. Each of those translations, like, you can feel how it's different. And what I always tell people to think about is, like, when I was working on this, I spent a lot of time thinking about like the nature of magical translation. And I started doing a lot of reading about like biblical translation, which is very similar, right? In that like, and I, especially having grown up Jewish, I am very aware that like different Bible translations are super different and deeply biased in lots of different ways.
Especially the King James Version.
Right, which is beautiful poetry. It's not like, but like, grossly misstates, like, as a Hebrew reading Jew, I'm telling you, grossly misstates some of that text. Intentionally twists it, is what I'm saying. And like, but again, I think literal translation of sacred text is like not what it's there for, right? So, but thinking about it that way is really what made me like crave that close context. So it started off, I just really wanted to know more about these hymns. And it turns out once you fall down that rabbit hole, at the bottom of that rabbit hole, you just have to retranslate them yourself.
My next question was going to be, as you call it, a game of translation, from the perspective of somebody reading and using your book, is there room for adaptation?
Yeah, absolutely. So In some places, I add some footnotes and tell people, especially look, there are a few places where I just deviated. Like, I changed the meaning of the text. I footnoted them, and I did that for reasons. But, like, for example, in the hymn to Hercules, the hymn praises him for, like, putting down the savage races. And, like, I wasn't gonna say that. Like, I don't want to pray that. And I like to imagine most people reading this book don't want to pray that. So I just put suppressing savagery. But that was enough of a change that I felt the need to note it. And in most of those cases, I actually provide an alternative couplet. But I strongly encourage people to adapt them. In particular, the last couplet, for some of them, last two couplets are like a request. And those, when you use them as spell work, like, I always rewrite them for the specific one at hand. So even in really simple ways, like the hymn to, like, Hygieia for health is probably the one that I pray as a prayer most often, right, for people. And I just always rewrite the last couplet to have their name in it. And then in the second edition, there's an appendix at the end with advice for just writing your own hymns in this style.
Interesting.
Right. So I'm very much in favor of people adapting them. But, I mean, they should appreciate that the more they move them, like, at a certain point, they're not the Orphic hymns anymore. They're, like, inspired by the Orphic hymns. But unless they're selling books about them, I don't think that distinction is very important.
Yeah. Okay, so in your book, you describe a specific type of spirit called a Herma. What is this exactly? And what is the art of the Hermeneutes? Is that how Hermeneutes. It's pronounced?
Yeah. Let me talk about those as sort of two separate things. I'm going to talk about Hermi first, and then I'll talk about Hermeneutes. So a Herm, or sometimes it's Herm, sometimes it's Herma. It depends on, like, how people put it into English. It's a pile of rocks, and it's the oldest kind of idol of Hermes, right? So Hermes is, among many other things, the god of messengers and travelers and roads and travel. And so, like, a big pile of rocks is the most ancient form of road sign, right? You still see them on, like, at least in the States, on, like, hiking trails. You'll see them sometimes to mark hiking trails, cairns of rocks. Well, that is a Herm, right? And then over time, that evolved into, like, a pillar with a head of Hermes on the top. But that's what a Herm is, right? It's the oldest form of Hermes, the messenger god, and it's like a road sign, right? So that's what a Herma is, a Herm. I, by the way, think that Hermes' name comes from the word Herm and not the other way around, but it's really unclear. Like, I don't think we really know, but I believe that it goes that order. And then a Hermeneutes is like is an epithet for her. Well, okay, the word Hermeneutes is not fully translatable. I sometimes translate it as a Hermesonaut, but it means like a person who does Hermes shit. But in context, when it's applied to a human person, it's a job description. It means like a translator or a like go-between or a scribe. If anybody's watched the TV show Rome, the character of Posca is Julius Caesar's Hermeneutes. Like, that's what that job description is. But it is also a divine epithet applied to Hermes, right? And so Hermes Hermeneutes is like a go-between, is a familiar given by Hermes, right? That like fills that role in a magical sense as a sort of like translator and go-between. And so I work with my Hermeneutes as like basically a like magical translator when I'm talking to not humans. Because like, as much as I learned ancient Greek, like I'm not gonna learn to speak like oak tree. Like I'm trying, but there's a limit to how much oak tree I can learn, right? And I try, I listen real hard to that tree and I know enough oak tree to like understand if its leaves are turning yellow, why, and like what I should do about it. Like I speak a little tree, but I am not fluent in tree. And so Hermeneutes is a familiar spirit, a tutelary spirit. Maybe I don't want to use the exact word tutelary there, but a familiar spirit that I work with in that context. And so there's a ritual for like courting one in the book.
All right. So I followed your advice at the beginning of the book and went and found one of the gods which inspired me. And mm-hmm. we went to read it out loud in my temple at an uh-huh. appropriate hour. I chose Persephone, as it seemed apropos, given that at the time of the recording, we had recently moved into autumn. I really enjoyed the reading and found it radically different from the Thomas Taylor translation that I'm particularly used to. And although it contains all of, the same beats, could you tell us anything in particular about this specific hymn and the process that you went through in its translation, just as a to encapsulate a little something of how you went about doing this?
So remember what I said before about, like, you can tell who my favorites are? Well, Persephone is definitely on that list, right? Like, I, if you let me, will wax rhapsodic about the compost cycle as a sacred mystery. So I will say that, like, the deeper a relationship I have with the spirit, the, like, maybe more comfortable I felt putting a little bit of my own spin, because I felt like I could do that with, like, Persephone's authentic voice. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, I have gone below and seen many, many things. Like, that is an initiation I have. Like, I wept in the cave at Eleusis. Like, I have a deep relationship with Persephone. And I feel like, which I mean in a very literal, like, not astral way. Like, there's a cave and I was in it and I wept for, like, an hour. And it was a whole thing shortly after my parents died. And so I feel, like, sort of authorized to speak on behalf of Persephone in a way that I do not feel authorized to speak, for example, for, like, Apollo, right? Or Athena, or any of those good proper government gods. Which is maybe an unfair characterization of Apollo in particular. But what you said about it containing all the same beats. So for all of them, my process starts with, okay, the phrase mechanical translation is a, like, linguistic jargon. It doesn't mean machine translated, like AI translated. It means that, like, you translate the same word in Greek as the same English word every time, right? That's called a mechanical translation. But as we all know, language is weird and poetry is particularly weird. And so, like, that does not produce a translation that either is, like, nice, but also it doesn't produce a translation that actually captures what it means, particularly in the case of poetry, which in its essence, poetry is like shapes you make out of your breath. Like, that's what poetry is. And so, like, the sound of it really matters, right? More, even more so than in other, like, I would say the defining characteristic of poetry versus other kinds of writing is that the sound of it, the, like, is as important as the meaning of the words, right? So the first thing I do is I read the hymn in Greek a bunch of times and really try and, my goal in translating, I always think to myself, like, if Orpheus were today writing this in English for Americans in particular, like, I'm writing in American English specifically, like, how would he say it? That's always my goal, right? And in particular, sometimes that means I have to add in a little bit of extra context. Like, especially when there's, like, places referenced, sometimes I will take just a place name and spin it up into, like, an entire line of poetry, because I don't think people know where that place is. I mean, some of them I didn't know. I had to, like, look on a map and research them, and I'm, like, a big nerd about this stuff. So I feel like if I didn't know it, I better explain what it is. For Persephone in particular, like, I maybe really leaned into that Eleusinian understanding of Persephone I have, but it always starts with, I read it in Greek a bunch of times, I read everybody else's translations, and I read, like, any kind of, like, you know, a lot of them have, like, academic journal articles written about them, so I read those as well, right, and kind of, like, get a gist of it, and then I do this mechanical translation, and then it's just, like, a slow, hard process of, like, twisting it into poetry. But I will say, and also, that, like, upper class British 1800 bias is, like, more apparent in some places than others. And I feel like Persephone is maybe the exact mystery that patriarchy doesn't care for. And so, like, you know what I mean? Like, I feel like some of them are, like, a little more than others, but also, I don't know. I really love Persephone a lot. Like, in particular, there's a form of Persephone, right? That is sort of like Persephone crossed with Hecate, crossed with the Resh Kigal, crossed with Artemis, that is sort of like the PGM witch queen kind of thing. And I am so there for that. Like that is a power close to my heart. I keep looking up because my Persephone idol is like right off camera.
I'm entirely sympathetic to your preference here, because for me too.
Yeah,
especially in the PGM readings of some of the spells, I find them, those in particular, to be exceptionally powerful.
So I tangentially mentioned this, but I really want to throw this home. I cannot mean this more literally. Putting your hands in compost at every phase of the garden year, there is no better way to come to understand the mystery of Persephone. I really mean that in the most literal sense possible.
Interesting. So like decomposition of matter, rebirth, all of those things.
Persephone, we talk about Persephone sort of always on the like descending end, right? The Persephone is the queen of hell, the like goddess of death, but Persephone is also
rising
up. You know,
up.
The force of spring that pushes seeds to blossom and blossoms to fruit. Like it's the entire cycle of that. And I feel like planting things and composting them in the fall and like that and watching that play out in real time. Yeah.
You're engaging in a catabasis.
Exactly.
By doing that.
And like at least in America, I'm gonna assume in other English speaking as well, we talk about a food chain, but it's a food cycle. There's a whole bottom half of it with like mushrooms and bacteria and things.
Just as important.
And I feel like
more complicated, more in depth because of the process.
It's definitely like harder to understand for those of us who breathe air. Like we live in the bottom of heaven. And so I think we are by nature pretty blind to things that happen under the earth.
Okay. So thanks for that, Sarah. That was really cool. Last question. Could you describe something of the self-initiation ritual which you have included in your grimoire? And why do you think that undergoing such a process is so important?
Okay. So at the very the thing that we're talking about, I put at the end of the book in the second edition. But in the first edition and in like actual Greek manuscripts of the Orphic hymns, it's actually the first thing, right? And it's this hymn called the hymn for Musaios. So remember a long time ago, I said there were four ancient Greek urbards, but I actually realized I only told you about three of them. The fourth one is Musaios, who some people say is Orpheus's teacher, and some people say is Orpheus's son. I just assume he named his son after his teacher, and that resolves that problem for me. But Musaios, I generally, in this context in particular, actually understand it as a, by the way, some people say that Musaios is the same person as Moses, which I think is ridiculous, but also really cool. Like, it's a cool idea. I think about that a lot, but I'm skeptical about the historical accuracy of that sentence. So Musaios means like the one of the muses. It means like the musy person, right? And so I understand that, at least in this context, and like maybe I'm crazy, but this is how I understand it. To me, it's like a cult title. Like you've been touched by the muses. Like, you know, Orpheus is a bard. And so Orphism is like a bard cult, right? You can tell, especially if you read the hymn to Apollo, you're like, oh wait, this is a sacred hymn that maybe this is not clear in English. It's probably not at all clear in my translation because I am not a musician, but like there's a lot of technical stuff about like ancient Greek music theory in that hymn that I only kind of theoretically understand as not a musician. So like Musaios, a person who is touched by the muses, Orpheus is the child of the queen of the muses, so I understand that to be like an Orphic initiatory title. And so the first hymn, the text says basically like, learn this hymn, it's the best spell there has ever been. And when I read that, I was like, yes, please. Okay. And so that is basically a very quick, like it sort of runs through all the gods fast, right? In the span of like maybe in Greek, even much faster than mine, right? Like but mine is, I don't know, 2.5 pages maybe, right? All the gods the whole way through. Interestingly, not exactly the same list as the Orphic hymns themselves, which makes me think, and I think scholars agree, that like the Hymn to Musaios and the rest of the Orphic hymns maybe were not written exactly together and they got together late. They might be different authors because there's a difference in the list of gods, and there's also a slight difference in the like style of the Greek. So it's just a really, it's just basically the way I wrote it, it's in couplets, right? And I kind of wanted to be like, how do you get to be muse touched? Like, how do I get to be one of these musaioses? And the essence had to be in this spell for the musaios, right? So I sort of constructed this initiation out of that hymn and also out of some other ancient Greek texts. There's a PGM one called like, there's a PGM initiation called like For Orpheus the Initiator. And that is like, so there are these building blocks that I put together to form this initiation, which like the essence of it is just memorize that. Like there's more to it than that, but that really is like the sort of essential initiation is you just memorize the poem.
And this essentially makes you muse touched. That's the phrase you use, right?
Yes, I am trying to translate the word musaios,
right,
which means like muse person, but muse touch. And at least my experience of it is that it is like I'm making gestures with my hands that are not helpful at all in audio, I realize. The icon for the muses in the book has this picture of like little muse elves just like messing around in somebody's brain, right? And like that's my experience of the muses, is I can like feel them putting stuff in my brain. Like, and so that is sort of the essential, like, I guess, state of consciousness that I am trying to inculcate in that hymn, both in a like immediate sense, like you can recite the hymn without the initiation, you just recite the hymn when you like need inspiration. Although in truth, I think the Hymn to the Muses is better for that, right? But also as a like long-term thing, you can like establish a relationship with the inspiring spirits of Orphism, who I understand to be the muses. Like, not the inspiring spirits of Orphism, the inspiring spirits of the Orphic hymns in particular, right? The inspiring spirit of Orpheus, who is a son of the muses.
Right.
So that's sort of like the function of that ritual. And people have reported good results. So it works for at least some people who aren't me.
Well, especially as the title of your book is the Orphic Hymns Grimoire, it's pretty important, I think, to give people a doorway to walk through to begin the process so that they can begin the work. But they've essentially created a point in time where they've, like an initiation point where they've said, okay, this is it. This is the liminal process where I've taken a step through this door. And I've
absolutely,
yeah, and I've,
and I much easier than the traditional Orpheus initiation, which is to die and then come back to life, which like I am not encouraging people to do anything dangerous, but near death experiences are powerful magical initiations.
Yeah. All right.
That's been my experience.
Thank you so much for that, Sarah. I've really enjoyed this conversation, and the absolute wealth of information that you have packed in this text is honestly beyond measure. I'm really grateful that you came onto the show. How can our audience find you online? And do you have any upcoming books or projects which we should keep our eyes open for in the future?
Thank you for having me. First, I have also had a lot of fun. The easiest places to find me online are Witch Lessons, like witchlessons.com. That's me. Or you can just Google search my name. If you put quotes around it, like Sarah Mastros is not a common name. So if you put quotes around it, I'm going to come right up in that Google search. But you got to use quotes because it thinks my name is Sarah Mastro, which is not my name. Those are the easiest way to find me. In terms of upcoming, when is this going to be on the air?
This will be on the air on the 20th of October.
Okay. Because I have stuff in between now and then. Okay, so after that, my next live appearances are at the Convocation Conference in Detroit in February, and then the Sacred Space Convention in Maryland in like Easter weekend, the last weekend in March. And then June 23rd, maybe, whatever that Saturday. I'm going to be at the Magical Women's Conference in Birmingham in late June, and I'm sure that the text that you are seeing with this audio recording will tell you when that is. And then I am doing a reading at Watkins in London, like later that week. And then I am doing a lunar witchcraft retreat in Italy in July. And COVID, I really like doing in-person appearances. And during COVID, I didn't get to do any. So now I booked a ton of them. But between you and me, now that I say that schedule out loud, I'm like
You're busy.
regretting it. Yeah. Like I after that, I guess I'm never gonna leave my house again right now is the plan. In terms of upcoming projects, let's see. I currently have an Introduction to Witchcraft course running that just started. People can still join. I have a course on the Solomonic Pentacles that similarly just started and people can still join. And then I have a book on the Solomonic Pentacles coming out January, let's say 8th, the first week in January. And that's from Wiser Books, and it is called The Sorcery of Solomon, A Guide to the 44 Pentacles of the Magician King, I think is the
Very
title.
nice. Very nice. All right. Well, excellent. I'm really looking forward to reading more of your work in the future, Sarah. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. I had a great time.
That was Sarah Mastros describing in wonderful detail the nature of the Orphic hymns and their role in both history and modern practice. Her book, The Orphic Hymns Grimoire, is well worth having on your shelf, not only for the excellent artwork by Brian Charles, but the content and overflowing wealth of information which is packed around these hymns shows that Sarah is not simply a translator, but a genuine practitioner. To those of my fellow grimoire workers, witches, and cunning folk who are interested in what Jake Stratton-Kent referred to as liturgical transplant in his book Goetic Liturgy, it is through material such as this that we can explore the chthonic reaches of myth and historiola to expand our understanding of ancient practices while framing them in a modern context. I would also like to specifically note that no goats were sacrificed in the making of this podcast. You will find all of Sarah's links in the description below, and I'm sure it won't be long until I have her back in the future. Please subscribe, like our videos, comment, and share if you can, so that we can reach our goal of 1,000 subscribers by the end of the year. I really hope that you enjoyed this conversation, and I look forward to seeing you again in the next one.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.